The Zionist dream had two basic elements to it. It was woven of two strands. The first was the expectation that a Jewish state would allow our people to live normally, as other people do. Not always looking over their shoulder, worrying whether they were being followed, worrying about what they could say and how they could say it. And the other related theme was the idea that in a Jewish state, our culture could evolve naturally without always being afraid of expressing its distinction, its difference from the cultures that were around us. Jewish state is now somewhat over a third of a century old. And in many ways, these two elements of the Zionist dream have been realized, but they have been realized not without their contradictions, not without their ironies. 1981 was a year in which some of these contradictions and these ironies became clear for all of us to see. In November of 1981, the respected Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem, a social research institute, issued a study on the reading habits of Israelis. And in many ways, it suggested that the people of the book had become the people of the box. The average Israeli read very little. 35% read nothing at all. 25% occasionally looked at the newspapers. 6 in 10, in other words, had essentially given up, for all but the most practical of reasons, literacy. But almost every Israeli who could watched television, and in that respect was very much like we, their counterparts in other parts of the world. Not only did they read very little, but what they read was of little value, little quality. According to this study, the average Israeli home has 206 books displaced about it. And as in most of our homes, most of those books are children's textbooks and the kind of paperback suspense stories, romances, and novels that you pick up in the drugstore. 86% of all Israelis had never looked into the Talmud, never once in their life. 64% of Israelis had not looked into the Bible, not once in the last year. The people of the books becoming the people of the box. And if I can speak, as I generally speak as a rabbi for a moment, I want to take as my theme this morning the simple truth that though there are dangers aplenty without, and though most Jews worried throughout last year about anti-Semitism, particularly political anti-Semitism, and certainly continue to worry about Arab intransigence, I worried more, I must confess, about illiteracy and indifference and ignorance of our cultural tradition in all parts of the Jewish world. We saw in December of 1981 that even when there are almost no Jews, as in Poland today, a community once numbering nearly 3 million Jews in the 1930s, now numbering less than 6,000, when things go wrong, when solidarity must be crushed, mistakes that solidarity made, according to the military government, are ascribed to its infiltration by Jews and by Zionists and by American imperialists, and they're all one and the same. The mills of anti-Semitism continue to churn out their ugly canards in the Soviet Union, in the Eastern Bloc, in the Arab world. There is always the danger of a fifth Arab-Israeli war. Certainly, we've had enough casualties from the first four. So I don't mean to minimize the external dangers that faced Jewish survival in 1981. But Jews have faced worse dangers. And We're long-lived. We've survived. What no Jewish community has survived was the loss of its heart, the loss of understanding and of its traditions, the loss of the spiritual energy which keeps Jewish life alive. We have been, over the last century, a very practical people. We have seen the advantages of the changes that were taking place in the development of the modern nation state and the development of modern technology. And we've gained the skills, and we've opened the doors, and we've walked through the doors, and we've taken advantage of all that there was to take advantage of in the larger world. In America, we represent the single group, ethnic group, minority, call us what you will, which has taken most advantage of American opportunity, whose income level is the highest. In Israel, we have created one of the few states from the third world which has emerged into modernity, into technology, as a modern community. But something's wrong. Something's missing. And what's missing is missing here in America, is missing in Israel. And that is an awareness and understanding of why we maintain our distinction, our difference, an awareness and understanding of the unique teachings which course at the heart of the Jewish experience. We were in Israel in May of last year, and Del and I visited a kibbutz called Amiad. Amiad is a small kibbutz which sits just above the western edge of the Sea of Galilee. It's a kibbutz which was established largely by Canadian and British, by Western Jews. And one of the members of that kibbutz had been in Cleveland for a number of years as a shliach to our Jewish Community Federation. I'd come to know him well and work with him closely. We were guests in their home. It was the unusual home. It was a home which was filled with books, serious books, well-read books. And we were talking about the changes that were occurring in the life of the kibbutz. The kibbutz had just 2 years before voted to reverse its earlier policy and to allow the children to be raised in the home rather than in dormitories. Now, this was a difficult decision for that kibbutz. It reflected a basic change in its early socialist ideology. It was an expensive decision for the kibbutz because it required that it build an extra room in almost every home that was on the grounds. But as we began to talk about this change, which is not an unusual change in many of the kibbutzim, we talked also of the patterns of growth and adaptation of the young people. We were told that as the youngster graduates from secondary school in the kibbutz, or when he completes or she completes their military service, they're sponsored by the kibbutz to a Wanderjahr, a year of wandering abroad, a year in which they can get to know the larger world, because the kibbutz world is a very small community. And one of the things that had troubled the kibbutz as they looked back on a 10-year experience with this Wanderjahr was that in almost every year, one or another of the boys and girls who had graduated from the kibbutzim who went out into the larger world gravitated to one of the gurus, or one of the cults, or one of the strange and exotic religious communities, not necessarily a Jewish community, which have been part of our Western culture in these last 20 or 30 years. There's a spiritual hunger, even in this intense socialist kibbutz, for something which the kibbutz had not been able to provide. The spirit was not satisfied. Now, this kibbutz had decided that one of the older members who had some knowledge of Jewish tradition should give a seminar from time to time to the high school students on the classics of the Jewish tradition. And they'd added to Moses Hess and Pinsker and Achad Ha'am and Karl Marx and their library, the Midrash and the Talmud, and some of the other classics of our tradition. They were responding to the theme that I'm suggesting to you. They were responding to the fact that as in Israel, as in America, an inordinate number of young Jews, disproportionate to the number of our population, the population, have been attracted to the cults, have been attracted to the gurus, have been attracted to those groups which seem to many of us to be bizarre, but which do provide answers, spiritual guidance, spiritual enlightenment, things which the synagogue, the Jewish community ought by naturally to provide, but which it has not provided in the last 100 years or so to many. Man does not live by bread alone. This is a truth which, though it comes from another tradition, our tradition ought to consider and to remember. We are a religious civilization. And when the religious element in that civilization is forgotten or overlooked, then there is great danger to the survival of the people. And I must say that I have been increasingly troubled as I have pondered these last years by the preoccupation of our community with externals. One of the headlines in the first edition of our Cleveland Jewish News for the new year read, 100% increase in anti-Semitic activity in the United States. And it listed some report by the Anti-Defamation League that there were some 960-odd anti-Semitic incidents. Most of these incidents were simple vandalism committed by adolescents or post-adolescents. Very few of them were very serious. The American Nazi Party and the Klan are still minuscule elements, and there is still, of course, the overarching protection of the law in the United States. But there's a bit of paranoia in the Jewish soul today, a bit of Holocaust-born paranoia. There is a great deal of difference when an Arab throws a grenade into a group of Jewish school children before a center or a synagogue in Brussels, and the kind of scrawling of a dirty Jew or of a swastika on the wall of a Jewish cemetery or synagogue in the United States. Neither of them is anything but vicious and ugly. But one is a threat to life and to limb, one is a political act, and one is simply the act of ignorance, frustration, prejudice, which cannot have a great deal of follow-up. We in America are going to see in the years ahead, as long as the economy remains stagnant, we're going to see a rise in all kinds of prejudice. Anti-Semitic prejudice, anti-black prejudice, anti-Catholic prejudice, anti-Mexican-American prejudice, anti-WASP prejudice. It's just natural that when times are difficult, people are frustrated and they take their frustrations out upon a stereotype, the enemy, capital T, capital E. But I very seriously doubt that American Jews find themselves in a position where there needs to be mass meetings about the dangers of anti-Semitism in the United States. What there need to be are mass meetings about the dangers of Jewish illiteracy and ignorance and cultural indifference in the United States. For here, as in Israel, we are raising a generation of young Jews to have a Judaism which is as thin and as pallid as that of the majority of their parents. And Judaism cannot survive because it has little to offer under that kind of situation. It is a label imposed from without rather than a loyalty which emerges from within, and to which there is a natural desire on the part of a young person to commit himself or herself. And because of this massive indifference to Jewish learning, Jewish spirituality, the absence of piety in the home, the absence of Jewish books on the shelves, and more importantly, of Jewish books in the hand and in the mind, because of this widespread indifference to all that makes for spirituality and makes for learning and understanding, a strange thing has happened in our communities, both in Israel and here. And that is that as we have developed our culture, it has been developed in two separate worlds. When you visit Israel and you visit the Hebrew University, you visit Haifa, you visit Tel Aviv University, you visit the University of the Negev, you walk into very modern, very well-developed, beautifully articulated research laboratories, libraries, classrooms where advanced learning is taking place, but it is denatured learning. It is the learning of the technological age. Side by side with that is what passes for Jewish learning, the old-fashioned yeshivot, worlds which are medieval in construct and in substance. And these two worlds hardly touch. And increasingly, because of this interest of the majority world with all of its talents in the religious element of our religious civilization, control of that religious element is given over to the most orthodox of the orthodox. Once upon a time, we thought, most of us still think, of Jewish life in American Israel as divided between three denominations, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. More recently, it's been truer to say that there are four denominations in Jewish life, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and Fanatic. And the Fanatics are called Haredim, which in Hebrew means those who are full of fear and of trembling, fear and trembling before the Lord, to whom nothing else matters. Nothing else matters save the four L's of the Talmud, save the old-fashioned world of Eastern Europe with which they were once familiar. They are the stone throwers in Israel who throw stones against cars that pass by their quarter on the Sabbath. And because of the peculiar political context of Israel, they have gotten more and more political power and been corrupted, as inevitably all groups are, by that power. In 1981, there was an election in Israel. The election ended with the Likud, Mr. Begin's party, receiving 48 votes, 48 seats in the new Knesset, Labor receiving 47 seats in the new Knesset. You need 61 seats to organize the Knesset and to organize a government. And the control of that swing vote was entirely in the hands of the three ultra-Orthodox parties in Israel. And these parties are in the hands of those who are the most Haredim, the most Orthodox of the Orthodox. There is an intelligent, understanding, moderate Orthodoxy which understands the need to live in two worlds. So it's the largest group within the Orthodox tradition. But it's not the most active, it's not the most fanatic, it's not the most politically powerful. And so it is these Haredim who increasingly are determining the nature of our religious life. The paradox of the Zionist dream. We created a Jewish state so that Jewish life and Jewish culture and Jewish religious civilization might naturally evolve. In point of fact, in the Jewish state, one can almost say that Jewish religious life has dissolved, that it has turned inward, turned upon itself, sought to become medieval again, rather than to adapt itself into modernity. And because of this powerful swing vote of these three small Orthodox parties, in 1981, Mr. Begin, in order to form a government, agreed with these parties that won to a number of their demands which have escalated with each election. All yeshiva students are to be granted exemption from military service. Most women from the Orthodox community are to be granted similar exemption. The building of dormitories for yeshiva students is to take precedence over all other similar kinds of building projects in Israel. The yeshivot are to be given financial aid by the number of students equivalent in exact dollar terms to the aid given to the major universities, although of course they have no needs to have laboratories or expensive equipment or libraries of the dimension that the universities themselves must provide. Those who are Baalei Tshuva, those who claim that having suddenly seen the light and joining the Orthodox group, are to be granted these same privileges. The ports of Israel are to be closed on the Sabbath. The airport is to be closed. El Al is not to fly, which means that El Al really can't fly two of the 7 days of the week. And this for an airline which lost $40 million last year. And most importantly in all, because it affects Jewish life both in Israel and out, the law of the return is to be amended so that a Jew will be defined as one who has a Jewish mother or one who has been converted to Judaism by the Orthodox law. We will then have in our community two kinds of Jews for the first time in our history, those who are acceptable to the state legally, and those who are more than accepted in this congregation and most other congregations as full Jews, because in fact they are. The issue in Israel has become increasingly tense and increasingly dangerous, because it is a politicized, medieval, fundamentalist, fanatic orthodoxy by which Judaism is being labeled by those who are growing up in relatively secular homes, and obviously they're going to react very strongly against it. Some of the pressures that the Haredim brought against the community in Israel, against the government, were almost burlesque in their effect. For the last 3 years, archaeologists have been conducting a major dig in what's called Kiryat David, the city of David, which is the oldest section of the city of Jerusalem. When you, as a visitor, as a tourist, go into Jerusalem and enter the walled city, you think that you are in the old city. In fact, you are in a Roman city and a medieval city. The city of Judean times lies to the south, outside the wall, down towards the valley of Kidron. It looks from the outside simply to be rubble. But in the last 20 years or so, first an expedition led by Kathleen Kenyon, and now an Israeli expedition have been working on this site in order to uncover it and to understand it. In 1979, rumors began to circulate among the Haredim that this site had once been a medieval cemetery. And therefore, they believed it ought not to be disturbed. In 1980, one of their black-coated, black-hatted members was walking by the site when he claimed he saw a bulldozer turn over ground which included a human foot. And immediately a great frenzy arose among the Haredim, and they demanded that the dig be closed down. The archaeologist refused. In June of 1981, the Haredim issued a Pesak Din, a rabbinic injunction, which demanded that all work cease, and when the state refused to agree, the troops of the Haredim, their young thugs, if there can be religious thugs, the young thugs broke into the perimeter and did a good bit of damage on the site. The police restrained them. The case was settled in the courts. The archaeologists were allowed to proceed. At that point in time, the man who was the chief rabbi of Israel, a man named Shlomo Goren, suddenly appeared on Israeli television with a bag of bones, which he claimed were bones of Jews who'd been buried on the site. He said for 2 nights he had clambered over the site. He'd ruined his suit in the process. And he'd found all of these bones. The archaeologists were lying to the public. And he had a stack of books with him before the television camera, which he said proved conclusively that this site had once been a cemetery. The archaeologists and some of the medical people said they were willing to examine these bones, and they found them to be chicken bones. And they were eager to examine these books, and Rabbi Goren could not produce a single reference from any of these books that this site had once been a cemetery. Nevertheless, when Mr. Begin required the votes of the Orthodox parties in the Knesset over the non-confidence vote which was submitted by Labor over the Golan Heights issue, the Orthodox parties agreed to that vote only if Mr. Begin would submit to the Knesset a rule which would give the chief rabbi of Israel the right to assent to give authorization for any dig to proceed anywheres in the state. The rabbinate has already received permission to interfere in almost all research and experimentation being carried out in the hospitals of Israel. Now it is to receive permission to assent or prohibit almost any historical research in Israel. A dangerous situation, obviously. And one which typifies this growing polarization between the majority of secularists among us and the minority of fanatics among us, and the absence of what we most desperately need, the large middle group of Jews who care about religious values, who care about cultural experiences, who care about the quality of the spiritual and the cultural life of our community, but who seemingly do not care enough to become active or interested or involved. We're a community of people frenetically doing a lot of things, except the most important thing of all. To understand what's at the heart of this tradition we say is worth sustaining, and to finding ways to making that heart beat strongly so that our young will understand and be moved to follow suit. I've chosen to review 1981 from this perspective because everybody else is reviewing it from a political perspective or from a perspective of community structure. And what I'm trying to say as strongly as I can is that the threat to Israel really does not lie in the fact that there's a temporary estrangement between our government of Israel and Israel. That's a problem. It does not really lie in the needs of Israel to build up its defense establishment or the threat posed to Israel by the sale of the AWACS and other $1 billion of military hardware to the Saudis by Germany and by England and by France and by the United States. These are problems of life and survival, to be sure. But I'm confident that in one way or another they will be met and they will be overcome. I am not that confident. I am not that confident that the problems of Jewish identification, of the problems of the deepening of Jewish culture, of providing the mechanisms by which the heart, the spirit of Jewish life can communicate itself to the next generation and to ourselves, that this problem will be met and can be met. We call ourselves a religious people. It's hard to find the religion among this people, except among those on the extreme right. On the extreme left, we have another kind of religion, ideologies of various economic types. But in the middle, what we have is an immersion of Israelis in Hebrew technology, an immersion of Americans in the American technology, a reading public which reads everything but that which is special, which might give them some understanding of the tradition, a community which rarely comes to the religious services of their communities. 1 in 2 American Jews attended services on one of the 2 days of the high holidays last year. We've talked often, and we have in our minds a stereotype of the revolving door Jew, at least the in on Rosh Hashanah, out in Yom Kippur. It no longer holds. The Jew comes in those doors one day of the year, one or the other, 1 in 2 of them. 1 in 2 does not. The political problems that our communities face are real. I think the American Jew is overemphasizing anti-Semitism, making too much of it, part because his national agencies depend upon the fear of anti-Semitism to maintain their membership roles, in part because of this paranoia, this projection of the shadow of the Holocaust upon incidents which are not in kind or in nature or in substance or in quality at all similar. But the Holocaust mentality, my friends, will not allow us to survive. Indeed, it may be counterproductive. If we're concerned about prejudice in these United States, then we've got to get the economy working again. We've got to find ways to establish social justice in the nation. We've got to maintain our contacts with all those who are concerned with the well-being of the society as a whole. And those who have this paranoia about anti-Semitism tend to huddle down, to pull in, to remove themselves from, rather than to remain open and concerned and committed. Yes, there may be residual anti-Semitism in many with whom we must work in these projects, just as there is residual anti-black feeling, anti-white feeling, anti-goy feeling among most Jews. But in the real world, if it helps to resolve the social, the economic, the political problems, you go a long way towards pulling out the worst of the sting that prejudice involves, at least the worst of its consequences. 1981 will be remembered as the year of the bombing of Beirut, the bombing of Baghdad, and the annexation of the Golan. And the world will think of Israel to a large degree as having been showing the pressures of a siege mentality during 1981. I can make the case, I've made it often from many platforms, including this own, that there was good reason, given a certain set of circumstances, for each of these actions. Some, like the bombing of the nuclear reactor, were carried out surgically and effectively. Some, like the bombing of Beirut, were carried out sloppily and ineffectively. But I don't think the problem which Israel faces is a problem of the siege mentality. It's the problem of lacking a spiritual heart, the problem of the Yordim, the problem of the 300,000 Israeli Jews who now live in these United States, who have come here. Why? Because if you're practical, if that's all that counts, it is practical to live in the prosperity of the United States as opposed to living in the stringency and the narrow limits of the Israeli economy. There's more opportunity. There's less red tape. There's more chance of making your fortune. A community which, in fact, was bound by some higher vision might hold many of these people. Not all, of course, because many people are not committed to any vision. But many might be held. But a practical people, this people of ours whose practicality we have so prided ourselves on, will find more and more leaving because they're flowing to those places where there's more bread and more financial and practical advantage. If we are to survive these next years, which will be politically difficult for Israel, for the Jewish community around the world, we've got again to find our hearts. And it's not going to be easy. We've got to find ways not only to be active, but to be contemplative. We've got to find ways to teach our children not only that they should involve themselves in the agencies of our Jewish community, but they should be understanding of and draw encouragement from the practices and the rituals and the worship of Jewish life. Now, God knows this morning I wouldn't talk, you know, to any of you about the reasons to come to a synagogue. We came here against the greatest of difficulties, and you know it's not my nature to berate any congregation for the people who aren't there. But still, I want to give to you as my assessment of 1981, the years before, and of course of the future, a sense of this feeling that I have. That if we are concerned about Jewish survival, we've got to take some of our energies away from structural matters, away from the political concerns. All these are important. All these must be dealt with. And look to the quieter issues, those that don't make the headlines. The number of Jewish children being raised here and in the Argentine, in England, in France, in Israel, who never in their homes see anything, participate in anything which can be called a meaningful religious experience. The fact that Israelis speak Hebrew doesn't make them good Jews. An Arab urchin in Nablus whose parents voted for the Communist Party can order a chocolate milkshake in Hebrew. We're talking about ideas, we're talking about God, we're talking about faith, we're talking about religious commitment, we're talking about moral values, we're talking about emotional experiences. And put all that against the empty bookshelf, the thinness of the religious life, the indifference to the religious practice, the 86% in Israel who have never looked into the Talmud, and the 90%+ in America who have never looked into the Talmud, the 64% in Israel who haven't opened the Bible, and the 70-some-odd% in America who don't open the Bible. That's where the future lies, or that's where the future fails. We rise to our enemies. We fall to our own cultural indifference. The Zionist dream was one which hoped that we would become like unto all others, able to live our own lives and to be able to unfold our own culture. Israel, the possibility is there. In America, I think the possibility is here also. We don't look over our shoulders. We really don't worry about what others will say about what we are saying. But can we honestly say that we have raised a culture which has been broad and deep, high-leveled? We've raised a few thousand to understand that culture, but we're a community of six million and some. And the same is true of Israel. And if I were to give you a parable appropriate to the new year, it would be the parable of the golem. In Prague in the 16th century, a famous rabbi by the name of Loewy, who was a friend of Johannes Kepler and had that mystique about him, you know, of being a scientist and still in the medieval age, was the leader of a besieged community, the ghetto. Young toughs of the town often attacked the Jews. And Loewy was supposed to have had magical skills, and he built himself a golem, an automaton. He took the clay and he put the name of God on the forehead of the clay, and the clay, the sorcerer's apprentice, came into being. And he put the sorcerer's apprentice, the golem, to work defending the Jewish community. And day in and day out, this golem, this automaton, walked the streets, protecting the weak, protecting the elderly, protecting the women from attack. But he had no mind. He only knew to protect, and he often couldn't separate friend from enemy. He often performed acts which were disastrous, because they were done without discrimination. And ultimately, despite the continuation of the attacks on the Jews, Rabbi Loewy had to reduce the golem to the clay from which he sprang, take off the name of God from off his forehead. Because a community, because a golem, because the defenders, if they lack understanding, judgment, and discrimination, history, the sense of the past, the knowledge of what we're all about, they're ultimately people who cannot defend us, because they don't really know what they are defending. We need an educated leadership, an educated fellowship, a committed home, a committed heart. All these, I know, are traditional rabbinic themes, but don't discount them because you expect them from the pulpit. They are true and basic and valid, nevertheless. Amen.